very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
The questions you always had, the answers you were never given, the place to seek the truth. Welcome to Veritas.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of Veritas at veritasradio.com. I'm your host, Mal Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, don't forget, we want to really welcome you home. And if you want to listen to tonight's full interview, all you have to do is subscribe, and you'll get your login immediately, and we'll have access to hundreds of hours of truth. And if you want to upgrade your life, then head on over to sanitasradio.com and listen to what we have to offer there. And if you want to contact me, want to be a guest on this radio program, have a suggestion, or just simply have some feedback, I always love to hear from you. Click on the contact button of our website. Tonight's guest will offer an original theory of the nature of meaningful coincidences or synchronicities and their practical uses from a non-supernatural point of view. This topic is on the cutting edge of the heated battle between spirituality and science. The findings are the outgrowth of his 45-year investigation, both as a professional observer of some of his synchronicity-prone psychoanalytic patients, as well as his own intimate experiences with these intellectually challenging and emotionally powerful occurrences. Rather than viewing these perplexing events as coded quote-unquote messages from some transcendent realm of spiritual reality, he concludes that meaningful coincidences are the surface manifestations of an individual's unique creative process, accommodating the best available resolution of a problem for a person initially feeling quote-unquote stuck in a seemingly intractable dilemma. His name is Dr. Gibbs A. Williams, PhD, a psychoanalyst practicing in New York. His choice of profession is an outgrowth of three major interests: philosophy, death psychology, and spirituality. He received a BA from Columbia University, majoring in philosophy, an MS in psychology from Yeshiva University, and a PhD from New York University. He is militantly opposed to the quote-unquote quick fix mentality in our nation, that mentality that tends to believe that normal feelings like anxiety and depression are to be suppressed or dismissed entirely, instead of translating their messages for personal well-being. Gibbs is a passionate in his conviction, and that significant change is possible, but it takes persistent hard work and a willingness to struggle with struggle. His new book is titled Demystifying Meaningful Coincidences or Synchronicities, The Evolving Self, The Personal Unconscious, and The Creative Process. And he joins us directly from New York City. Hello, Dr. Williams, and welcome to Veritas.
Hello, Mel. Glad to be on.
Glad to have you. This is one of those topics that we discuss all the time. And to have somebody who has experienced this for in your case, for yourself, and also you've had some of your patients also, it's very important to discuss it. But, you know, as I said before in other programs, sometimes we have two radio programs. And what you said, what I said, actually, during the intro, at the end of the intro, when you talk about being militantly opposed to the quick fix mentality, I don't want to digress from our topic here tonight, but the quick fix mentality, that really struck me, because right now there's a pill for everything. Instead of us allowing those, our bodies and our minds to perhaps heal, sometimes I understand that sometimes you need a little bit of help, but we seem to have that Band-Aid mentality. What do you think that is?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about that. I'm inclined to think that since we are pleasure-seeking mammals, which is understandable, we try to maximize pleasure and we try to get rid of pain. And I think, unfortunately, through propaganda and drug companies and politicians and all sorts of quasi-authorities, we've been filled with a lot of propaganda that there is a thing called perfection and that there's unlimited pleasure and that that problems do exist, but they have to have instant, immediate answers. So that feelings such as anxiety, stress, depression, and frustration mainly, although there are a bunch of others, are really treated as if, the drug companies will call them chemical imbalances. And of course they're chemically imbalanced, but the idea is not to just rebalance them through another drug. The idea is to accept their inevitability, and they all have to do with realistic limitations, which I think is not, it's a dirty word, limitations. We're not supposed to have limitations. Look at the campaign that's going on right now. Greatness seems to be equated with onward and great progress and, in effect, no pain. There is pain. And the key to success, it seems to me, is teaching kids how to bear increasing dosages of those four things, anxiety, depression, frustration, and stress, without the need for medication.
So meaningful coincidences or synchronicities, they have been with us since, correct me if I'm wrong, since the dawn of time. But who was the first to study this phenomenon scientifically, and what were the results?
The first to study it scientifically is probably the philosopher Schopenhauer. Perhaps there's others ahead of him, but he had a really good take on this thing, in which he, would you give me a second, and I will give you a fantastic quote.
Sure.
If I can get him real quick. It's a brilliant quotation.
Coincidence is the simultaneous occurrence of causally unconnected events. If we visualize each causal chain progressing in time as a meridian on the globe, then we may represent simultaneous events by the parallel circles of latitude. All the events in a man's life would accordingly stand in two fundamentally different kinds of connection. Firstly, in the objective causal connection of the natural process. Secondly, in a subjective connection which exists only in relation to the individual who experiences it, and which is thus as subjective as his own dreams, whose unfolding content is necessarily determined, but in the manner in which the scenes in a play are determined by the poet's plot. That both kinds of connection exist simultaneously, and the self-same event, although a link in two totally different chains, nevertheless falls into place in both, so that the fate of one individual invariably fits the fate of another, and is the hero of his own drama, while simultaneously figuring in a drama foreign to him. This is something that surpasses our powers of comprehension, and can only be conceived as possible by virtue of the most wonderful pre-established harmony. It is a great dream dreamt by that single entity, the will to life, but in such a way that all his personae must participate in it. Thus, everything is interrelated and mutually attuned.
Very interesting, because that to me, when the part of interrelated, and I know some people have a problem with this, the connection between science and spirituality. Do you think that synchronicities bridge that gap?
Yes, but not in the way that seems to be bandied around now. And what I'm talking about is the whole theory of quantum entanglement and the idea that everything's connected and, vibrations and so forth, all of that stuff. I think that is a very compelling and interesting theory that has zero to do with my view of synchronicities.
Now, doctors Carl Jung and Sigmund Freud both studied this phenomenon. Did they find common ground?
No. And as a matter of fact, a super coincidence or synchronicity, if anybody really wants to follow the history of this, is in 1905, Freud invited Jung to his library, and they had a incredible coincidence that occurred. At the time, Jung was the heir apparent to the Psychoanalytic Society, which Freud founded and was going to make him the next, it was like vice president, to make elevate him to the presidency. There was only one problem. Jung was increasingly more interested in occult studies and was very excited this particular occasion when they met to indicate to Freud that he really thought he had evidence that a phenomenon that he called exteriorization phenomena was real, and that he was very excited about it. Freud, although exceedingly interested in paranormal issues, as a matter of fact, said that if he had his life to do over again, he probably would have been a paranormalist. In any event, he's listening to Jung going on, and he's very much admired him and his enthusiasm for occult studies. But as Jung is talking, Freud is beginning to have the feeling that he's straying from the basic ideas that Freud had, and Freud issued him a warning and said, look, do me a favor. Don't get stuck in the mud of occultism. At which point, Jung, 25 years younger, felt patronized by Freud, and they already had a major difference in what they thought was basic to human behavior, Freud being sexuality and Jung being spirituality, and Jung got very angry, and he was everything he could do to not express his displeasure at Freud's rebuke, at which point, as he's talking about this exteriorization phenomena, there's a sudden clap, a very loud clap of noise in the library, and both of them were startled, and they said, what is that? And Jung says, that is an example of what I'm talking about. And Freud says, bosh, that's nonsense. Would you please, you know, get back to reality and be grounded? This is silliness. At which point, Jung describes in his autobiography that his chest began to glow like a red vault. Translation, he was really angry. And he said, spontaneously, in effect, oh, yeah, you think so? Well, it's going to happen again. And it happened again, and both Freud and Jung were extremely impressed. Freud was so impressed that in letters to Jung, and they're really interesting, even months later, he's trying to figure out what in the hell is that all about. So that was really a major coincidence, which in fact was the beginning also of a major disruption between the two of them. And in effect, Freud fired Jung, and Jung proceeded for the next 3 years to have a major breakdown. And in his breakdown, he went into himself, as many famous psychologists do, literally having breakdowns, and since nothing works, they have to reinvent a cure for themselves. And out of that came the Red Book and his own brand of psychoanalysis. It's called a creative illness. But that event was extraordinarily important.
But you would think that that event could have actually united them more, not separated them, because it happened not only once but twice. Isn't that the burden of proof in science?
Well, yes, except that one of the reasons why I love this subject, and I've been studying it for 50 years, is that the Freud-Jung differences are really part of a philosophical battleground that's been going on way before them in the form of philosophical first assumptions about the nature of reality and how we know reality, capped off by Plato, on the one hand, who's essentially Jungian, or Jung is essentially Platonic, and Aristotle, which is Freud, and those are the two poles of science and spirituality. So Freud being more in the camp of science, while he was impressed, he also didn't stop his critical thinking. And he said, look, this is really odd. However, there must be some kind of scientific explanation. Well, it was summertime, and he was out in his library weeks or months after he had this experience with Jung. And periodically, he would hear the same snapping sound. And he said, what is this all about? And he deduced that the weather, the summer weather, had dried out boards in his library. And when they reached critical mass, they would snap and they would make that sound. Of course,
like
what still didn't, still interesting is the exquisite timing that happened. Why did this thing happen right at a point where, you know, Jung was really upset and seemed to validate his point? And Freud concluded, well, coincidence would happen. It was very timely for Jung to have that occur. But that he doesn't think that there's any particular mystery to it other than good timing. Coincidences are sometimes coincidences. So that in effect, Freud being Freud, used his critical thinking to try to understand the so-called a causality of this mysterious event. And Jung being Jung, really felt that critical thinking beyond a certain point is really stultifying, and he went the way of so-called spirituality.
When I hear of these stories, for example, I interviewed Dr. Kirby Surprise a few years ago. He wrote a book on synchronicities, and he was telling me of his story. So you know him. So he was telling me of his story of when he was younger. I think he decided to park his car at a neighborhood and started looking at a house. And then with his mind, he thought, I want to demolish that house with my mind. All of a sudden, the house demolished itself. And he just couldn't believe what he saw. But in reality, there was a tractor behind the house demolishing the house, and he didn't see it, but it happened at the same time.
Now, this is good. This is the kind of stuff I like to hear, because on the surface, if you just take the surface events, some of these things are absolutely amazing. There's no question about it. However, my contribution is you can study these things scientifically by keeping a journal, not a diary, a journal of whatever is meaningful to you and date it, and you will find, and then also date coincidences that occur. If you put the date of the coincidence along with whatever journal material you have, you will supply psychological and sociological and historical context. If you look at the context out of which any synchronicity comes, my experience is that it's always triggered by an initial problem which seems to be unable to be resolved. And if you have an attitude that you're going to try to resolve it no matter what, then you start what I think is a psychological scavenger hunt in which you're looking for clues to give you the answer to the problem, and it's often unconscious. Bottom line, I think it stimulates a person's idiosyncratic creative process, and clues are amassed, and they're sort of like pieces of a complicated jigsaw puzzle. And when you make the boundary and you fit the pieces in, and when there are enough pieces, it'll show up as a pattern, and once that pattern will take the form of a coincidence and still has to be interpreted, and you interpret it like a waking dream. And when you do, there is always an intimate connection between the pattern, the synchronicity, and the problem that can be identified in the person's life. Now, using his as an example, I have found that most of the issues that surround synchronicities have to do with mixed feelings of love and hate called ambivalence, and that often the aggressive part is repressed, and when it comes out, it's often disguised in various forms, and just right off the top, without really understanding, you know, his particular thing, I would think that if he was able to tell you what the context was, he would tell you he was very angry about some relationship, past or present, and that he had very aggressive feelings that he may or may not have been conscious about. And it is not unusual to take something like fires or bombs or whatever and project, you know, have all sorts of feelings about them. And it just happened to be coincidentally that he had that kind of experience, and the thing blew up. I had a patient who whose earliest memory was at 4 years old, 5 years old, and he had a brother too. And he hated being alive, and he had a very bad relationship with his family, and he certainly couldn't stand the competition of his brother. He built a very tall wooden structure like a castle or something. The baby brother comes over, destroys it, and my patient's memory is he wished his brother would die. The next memory is that the brother is lying on a kitchen table, dead from pneumonia. Second series of experiences. My patient is 12. He's out in a field in the Midwest, beautiful sunlit day, and there's a Piper Cub. And he says to himself, wouldn't that be incredible if the plane crashed? A minute later, the plane was obviously on fire. It crashed, and these two memories fused together. Go convince my patient that he wasn't the male witch. And if you take the surface, you would see he would probably, you know, be thought of as needing an exorcism. The reality is that when we pieced everything together, all of this stuff happened. By 12, he's a very angry fellow. But at five, when he wished his brother dead, called sibling rivalry, his brother died of natural causes, probably about 3 weeks after he had that feeling.
Wow. Now, I know so many people, including me, who have experienced synchronicities. Perhaps you, folks who are listening, have experienced this, but most of us ignore them for a very long time, especially when we're younger. We try to use logic and use our, you know, conscious mind until an event occurs that you cannot deny. What do you think is really happening here?
Well, that's a great question, because I think that my experience personally and professionally is that these are really extraordinarily important events that happen. I think they happen to practically everybody. I do think there are personalities that are more prone to synchronicities. And what I find is that these people tend to have divided selves, and they're very much aware of it. And they often suffer from information overload. And they suffer from an inability to get unstuck. They get sort of paralyzed with doubts, and they get screwed up with mixed feelings. And that these things, I think, are an attempt to guide people into going into inner space and really trying to get themselves together. I came up with five basic attitudes that people have towards synchronicities. I guess there's a sixth that you introduced. They happen, they pay no attention. Then there's people who are very much aware of, and they sort of become like collectors. And these are the people that will endlessly tell you, either friends or themselves, or they read books and are endlessly flabbergasted by the latest coincidence. I think it can be used defensively, and I hope I am not insulting anybody when I say there is a danger that such people become synchronicity junkies, and they really use the latest excitement as equivalent to a shot of heroin. The next group are people who they collect, but they're more interested in their particular reaction to these things, which is often one of awe in the presence of the uncanny, and they sort of, you know, constantly scratching their head and figuring, like, this can't be happening. You know, this is amazing. And they like the amazement. And it's a really interesting feeling to be in a state of awe. Now, that's where Jung comes into the picture, and he had these things, and he was very impressed with that stage of awe, which he calls numinosity. And I call people who just stick with this stage bathing in numinosity. It's a great feeling. I appreciate it. I've had it. I like it. But I guess I'm too brainy, and I can't stop there. It just isn't enough for me. Because the third stage is the implications of these things. They often feel as if they're messages that are come from right above, or a realm of spirituality, or transcended to the self. They certainly don't seem to originate in oneself. And that, if you take that seriously, that starts you out on a kind of philosophical quest for answering questions like, well, let's say they are messages from some transcendent realm of experience. What are you talking about? What realm is that? And if there's a message, then there's an implied messenger. Well, who or what is sending you messages? And why you? Why are you so special that you're getting special messages from who?
Right.
Master teachers? God? I mean, come on. Now, that then stirred my curiosity to try to answer those questions. And my experience in philosophy indicated that If you don't go the route of they're external, then there's only one other place to look at, and that is you're sending yourself messages. It just doesn't feel that way, but somehow or other, there's some kind of something going on. Now, Jung got to this place, and his conclusion is that they are half-sent, they're half-psychological. They start with the self, and there's a psychology behind it. But then when the inside event connects with the outside event, in his way of thinking, there's no scientific way to prove that linear causality, you know, that the inside doesn't create the outside, and the outside didn't create the inside, and it must be like this kind of spooky connection. And he said that there is these two things are acausal, but that they are bound together by an equivalence of meaning. What I did was to start to examine these concepts which are taken for granted, like spirituality. And the big question is meaning. And I started to get involved in questions like, what's the meaning of meaning? And what's the relationship between meaning and causality? And in so doing, I came up with my own particular theory, which is the fourth thing, to try to understand theoretically what's going on. And whereas Jung throws out causality as something that you can't even you can't even imagine that there would be a rational explanation, is his rather pompous and I don't like people who are so certain that they can't leave other possibilities open, like scientific explanations. And he came up with three what he felt were irrefutable laws or principles, one of them having to do with method, the other having to do with meaning, and the other one having to do with time. And my work, essentially, is taking all of what he has said that is irrefutable and refute them and come up with an alternative form of an alternative theory. It's not the only theory in town, but it's an alternative one that keeps causality, but changes the definition of causality. It's not scientific causality. It's what I call psychological causality.
And then, what is the relationship?
The fifth thing is once you have it, irrespective of why you think they're theoretically how they come about, then the issue is, what do you do with them? How do you interpret them?
Yeah, but what is the relationship between causality and meaning then?
Good question. What Jung does is to throw out the idea of scientific causality or linear causality, cause and effect as we tend to know it, and says if you can't link these two things together with scientific causality, then you can't explain them rationally. If you, however, broaden the idea of causality and make it into psychological causality, then you can continue to make some kind of causal explanation, but it's going to take a different turn than what he would say. So I think he got caught up in trying to prove his spiritual point and wanted to demolish Freud's idea of everything can be scientifically understood.
Well, you're a truth seeker. I am a truth seeker too. We don't have the same background, but we have the same goal, I guess. Our synchronicities revealed, discovered, or created?
Once again, depends what you mean by discovered and or created. Now, what I think is happening is that we're talking about what is still to some extent a mystery, but a huge, huge, big issue called the creative process. And I think that with respect to the creative process, there, depending upon one's level of consciousness, these things, as like byproducts of creativity, can either be experienced as you discover it, or you create it. So, for example, Keats was supposed to have he had a famous poem called the Ode to a Grecian Urn. He says, and there's always reason to doubt him, that he went to sleep one night. He obviously had something in mind. He wakes up, and he had the whole poem, and he obviously must have had a photographic memory, and gets a piece of paper and writes it out, and it's unedited, and he's got a poem. That would seem to be discovered it. On the other hand, it came out of him, so he obviously created it. Now, I think what's really going on is that in place of the emphasis that Jung uses of the collective unconscious, which I think is a really neat and imaginative construction, and I'm not sure it's really true. In any event, so what is true? So let's say you throw that out as an explanation. I think what we're really talking about is the underrated and maligned personal unconscious. And then when synchronicities occur, the personal unconscious is becoming conscious. And by unconscious, I mean not verbalized, so that in dream images or language, when you can describe whatever your experience is in words, you're making the unconscious conscious. And synchronicities occur at a time where an individual is being able to verbalize what was previously in the unconscious.
Well, what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, then when I ask you, are synchronicities revealed, discovered, or created? I think the answer is it could be all of the above. They're revealed. Sometimes we don't identify them or discover them and create it because perhaps they come from our inner self.
Let me give you, I think you're right. Let me give you something which may make this concrete. I've had a number of patients, women patients in treatment, who come in and they're very jaded about being able to meet Mr. Right, and they've almost given up on it. And then every so often the question will arise, what would you, if you could, you know, have, seal your fate, what do you want? You want to get married? You want babies? The particular people I'm talking about don't even want to get near that subject. In terms of babies, why would a sensible person want to bring up a baby in such a chaotic universe? And that's where they start. After we work it through, and they discover issues, you know, as to why they're so upset, and they change their attitudes, if they do, it is not uncommon for such people to come in and spontaneously say to me, you know, as I was walking through New York City, as I always do, I am amazed at how many pregnant women there are. Now, let me assure you, I don't think there really an increase of pregnancies, maybe occasionally, you know, if there's if all the lights go off or, you know, this threat of war. But short of these big events, I would imagine the rate of pregnancies are pretty steady. So obviously, it is saying that these particular women who hated the idea are now getting turned on with the idea, and actively a trend is being set up here. So that if they then say to me a few months later, they're starting to actively go out, they're dating, and they have met the right guy, and guess what? You know, and so forth. You get the point.
I do. Now, going beyond science for a moment, is there a spiritual component to synchronicities?
You're asking really great questions. Here again, I will go, I guess, to my favorite or my major preoccupation with respect to studying these things. You want to give me your definition of spirituality?
That's a very good question. Well, first of all, everybody who listens knows that I used to be a Roman Catholic. I'm a recovering Catholic now. So I'm more of a spiritual person. I believe, again, that's a very important word. I don't know this, so some may consider me agnostic, if you will. But I believe that we didn't come from a big bang, that there's a powerful force behind the scenes. I also feel that the biggest conspiracy of all is the secret to our own potential. And we're always looking outwardly for answers. Somebody with degrees, no offense to you, somebody with a white robe, somebody from the government, when in fact we have a lot of those answers. So spirituality to me is, you know, the pursuit of those answers and what lies the power within.
You and I are going to have no argument. I came up with probably not original, but I came up with a definition of spirituality as a grounded spirituality. Let me just tell you how I arrived at it. In my practice, I have a number of addicts who were on heroin. And during this particular period of time, I had 5 dropouts from AA. They all struck me as God-obsessed, spiritually obsessed. However, they couldn't buy the what I think is over-rigidity of the 12 steps. Obviously works for some people, not my people. As I examined their early lives, I came up with that they each had, in terms of what their basic issues were, they were each one of them preoccupied with one of five issues, which and one or more of these five. The five issues were basic trust, faith, hope, love, and persistence. Now, fortunately, I've had enough of really good training to understand that if a baby could talk, a newborn, which they can't, that each one of them, we have inferred, would be preoccupied by those five issues. From my vantage point, those five issues are the core issues involved in spirituality. Once we work through those issues and filled up their sort of holes in their soul, one of them said at the end of it, you know, I feel as if, not only is this therapy successful, but I feel as if I'm not reborn. I feel as if I've been born for the first time. That, to me, is spirituality.
That's a good perspective. Now, when it comes to, at any time during the pursuit of your degrees, did you look into this phenomenon? How did you bump into it?
I came from Miami Beach, Florida. I escaped to Columbia University. In my second year, I had a functional breakdown. Very depressed, panic attacks. I was a mess. I had always been pursuing, like what you said about a truth seeker, I was infected with issues of identity. Who am I? What's the nature of reality? What am I doing here? Is there a meaning? How do I know it? And all that kind of stuff.
The fundamental questions.
Fundamental questions.
The primordial questions, yeah.
At age 17, I read a seminal paperback called The Story of Philosophy by Will Durant, and I almost shook on the bus reading it because the people that I was reading, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, they were talking my language, or I guess I was talking their language, and I felt more intimately close to them than I did my home that I couldn't stand. And that launched me into my philosophical interest. At that point, when I had that breakdown, I started what was to become a 27-year journal. And in the journal, which was just things that, I don't know, it wasn't a diary. It was things that somehow I was preoccupied with. And I had enough sense to do this. So I urge everybody to immediately start their own journals. They're really great. In any event, in the course of it, I happened to notice a few coincidences that I was amazed about and recorded them, and my journal of 27 years was peppered with what I call 19 major synchronicities over the span of that time, and my book was largely based upon that particular material, along with journals of patients who gave it to me unsolicited, and then I started to, you know, take a look at it scientifically. In the course of my pursuits, I went to two different therapies, one in starting with, as a sophomore, one 4 years twice a week, and the second twice a week. That was a few years later. Unfortunately, I didn't really understand what therapy was all about, and I figured therapy is calling a therapist and having appointments. Well, it's really not that. You really got to find somebody who really understands you, which I didn't understand at the moment. So from my vantage point, those therapies failed. However, I also became increasingly involved in the esoteric occult. I had met a few very interesting people, and they introduced me to the First Spiritualist Church of New York, which I attended faithfully every Sunday for years. And in the midst of that, I met some really interesting people, among them a rather noted psychiatrist who at some point went into trance and dictated what I took down is supposedly poetry from Freud and Jung and other such people. And it was in the course of, I guess, an interesting seance that I had what I believe was my first really major synchronicity that blew my mind. And then that introduced me into the literature in which I started to read all about Jung and synchronicities and so forth. And that stimulated my curiosity. And I guess I began to take it seriously. Oh, I guess there's one other event. On a summer, summer day, I was invited to go with one of the spiritualists to Ephrata, Pennsylvania, where they had a three-day convocation of spiritual occurrences like tarot readings and astrology and appearances of so-called ghosts and trumpets and all the whole deal. And as I'm sitting on the bus, a little old lady comes, whispers in my ear, and she says, "You know, you're really lucky." And I said, "Thank you. What am I lucky about?" She said, "You are going to be tapped into the Society of Saint Germain." And I said, "That's really quite nice. What is that?" She said, "You're going to find out. You're in for a good surprise." Okay, fine. A few minutes later, another little old lady comes, and she bends over, and she said, "You know, you got to be very careful." I said, "What do I have to be careful about?" She said, "You're probably going to be invited into the Society of Saint Germain. They're corrupt. They're phony. Don't listen to them." Well, that got me, as most of my experience in life, I came away feeling absolutely psychologically overloaded. I didn't know who to trust. I had already had some misgivings about part of what was going on, and I was ambivalent. So part of me said, all this stuff is really very interesting, and the other side said, you know, I guess like Freud saying to Jung, don't get too immersed in occultism. You better keep your critical thinking. And that really was, I think, the catalyst for me to start to see if I can't make a science out of synchronicities.
Well, I think that gives you a more balanced perspective, at least from my perspective. Now, some may ask, Doctor, of what importance is it to investigate the nature and use of synchronicities? What are some of the theoretical and practical issues?
I think this thing is, it's really a hot topic. For example, 7 or 8 years ago when I first started this, and I Googled, I remember Googling keywords like coincidences and synchronicities. Now, I'm making up these figures, but there was something like 50 references to synchronicities and probably a lot more to coincidences. If you Google those two keywords today, it's going to be astronomical. I mean, this thing is I don't know what your guess. I would imagine, since you have been on the program, that this must be a topic which interests you, and I know it's in the air, so that it's mushrooming all over the place. All right, why? It is in the interface between science and spirituality. It is an intellectual problem that stirs one's emotions. It looks as if it violates the laws, the Freudian laws of psychodynamics, apparently, and that it seems to give to adherents a sense that they are indeed being guided by, let's call it, spiritual forces, and that they're not exactly sure who or what this thing is, but it does feel that way. They happen, from my vantage point, at key moments in a person's life, so that when they're really big, and of course big is subjective, they happen at defining points where people tend to be quintessentially stuck, and when they have a synchronicity, it often feels as if it's the key to getting unstuck, so it has a lead-in to significant psychological change and transcendence. Also, what I have found is that with respect to this very murky and fascinating topic of consciousness and consciousness expansion, that it can demarcate with a patient where they are beginning in treatment, and you can use it, not only with their experiences, but more important, the meaning of their experiences, which is critical, and you can see clear progress with respect to and evolving consciousness. Those are some of the reasons why I love this thing. And while I think, at times it's like, all right, I've exhausted. I mean, how much can you say after 50 years? Oh, no, it keeps on being elusive. There's more and more. This is just the tip of the iceberg.
And this is very important to discuss because, as you say, it's the tip of the iceberg. But when I look at Jung telling Freud, hey, that clap is what I was trying to tell you. Didn't Jung say a science of this type of anomaly is impossible? Doesn't that contradict
a
little bit?
Yes. Now, once again, what do you mean by science? And let me tell you what my contribution is. He said, in terms of method, you can't use scientific method with these things because they're like flashes of firefly sparks. And you have to be able to pin them down in a laboratory and then, examine
control
where they
environment,
came from and so forth.
Replication, control environment, the whole nine yards.
Right. Okay. Well, he's right until you plug in the following. That's why keeping a journal is extraordinarily important in objectifying the subjective. Because when you do that, if you appreciate, as I think I do, that these things, while they appear to be coincidences, they're not really, if you see that they are embedded in context. So if you have an ongoing flow of experience, when synchronicities occur, you can trace back and see that they, I believe, really start with a seemingly unresolvable problem. If you can pin down what that problem is, and that's not difficult to do, you can see that the particular synchronicity and the meaning that people give to them is a resolution of a problem. So
now,
you can have a science of synchronicities.
Now, you identify, as I said, as a truth seeker. When I think of your psychoanalytic patients, what was the motivation you had to clear up the mystery as to the truth or the falsity of the, can we call them mystical implications of your own and your patients? How did you respond to them?
Well, good question. It is not a coincidence. There are purportedly 365 theories of therapy in which somebody is paying some therapist lots of money or a little bit of money to be cured of their psychological difficulties. Well, nobody can do, you can't practice 365 different theories. You got to pick one. I told you I already eliminated two of them. One was Gestalt therapy, and the other was Sullivanian, meant by very good people who were very decent, but it didn't do anything for me. I was left out in the cold. It was probably not a coincidence that I was attracted to the occult, because if you take something like the astrological wheel, that is a really interesting glyph because it symbolizes what my experience, and I think most people's experiences of daily consciousness. So you have this wheel, and you divide it into 360 degrees, and you have 12 houses, and those 12 and they seem to be opposed to each other, arranged in a kind of neat way. And what that, to me, is a representation of the whole self. What was missing in my previous therapies is that I was being looked at as, in a way, a collection of symptoms without really getting to what I would call my soul. So there was no unifying principle, which indeed was missing, and nobody put it in those terms. So I was, running around like a chicken without a head on and either over-theorizing or getting panic attacks. It was only until I got into my psychoanalysis in the very first day and felt, because my analyst was a good pick, I felt as if he really was responding to my totality. And during that, I discovered that I was mainly operating using intuition, and in the analysis, we plugged in critical thinking. And that became the basis for my able to, I think, move beyond Jung.
Now, here's a question, similar question I asked a researcher the other day, but her question was more about consciousness. What is, and I don't mean to derail, I think this is part of the conversation, what is the self and where is it located?
That was the first question my analyst asked me, and I said, that beats me, what do you think? The self, as I best understand it and fits me, is found in a the first real, I think, really classy definition of it was written by Heinz Kohut in 1950 in a book called The Analysis of the Self. His definition, and I think it's pretty good, his operational definition of the self is something at one's core that is solid in the midst of internal and external confusion, such that if you don't have a self and you're confused and asked who's yourself, you'll say, beats me, I don't know, I'm like a kaleidoscope, I'm this self and I'm that self and I'm reacting, I don't know who I am, I'm lost. If you have a self, you can feel very good and confused, but you will say, look, I'm not sure what's going on, but I feel unbelievably confused, I'm sort of lost in at sea. However, I know I am a solid person, I just happen to be confused, and there's a huge difference.
Now, does the self evolve, or is it always remaining stagnant?
Wonderful. The difference between, major difference between Jung and Freud is that from Jung's point of view, and being a Platonist, he believed his basic idea, like Plato, is that there is a unity to all reality, and that before one is born, there is, in the act of incarnation and the birth process, the unified self becomes split into various selves. And it's each person's mission to be able to appreciate that there is an inner world of division, and you have to make it your life's purpose, and he thinks it's your spiritual purpose, to reconcile the opposites and get back to a state of unity. All right, sounds good. Maybe so. However, the scientific vantage point of the self is that there is no self, that the self is essentially chaos. It just is. William James, who I love, said if you could talk to a newborn about their perception of reality, they would probably say something like, the world or reality is a blooming, buzzing confusion of sensation, and your job is to order your chaos. How does one order chaos? Well, hopefully you got one or more parents, or at least somebody who's attending to you, that has a reasonably good idea of what you may be needing. So they interpret the one of four cries as, you know, hunger or distress, and that they, if they sense that you're really out of it, they'll pick you up, take you in the back of the car. You understand what I'm saying? You're being loved and nurtured. And if you do that and the baby feels that their basic needs are being met, they will spontaneously grow an internal self. The problem today with addiction and all these other, might add, politicians, is that they probably do not have unified selves, and they kind of rationalize that they can let whatever self they want to just, you know, do whatever they want to, and that becomes the equivalent of, that's their idea of freedom.
And that leads me to the next question. What is the distinction then between the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious?
Also a good question. Not implying that your other questions aren't as good. The collective unconscious, as I understand it, is the... Well, let me start with the personal. That's what Freud came up with. Freud believed that the personal unconscious is the reservoir of all those kind of feelings and experiences which, for some reason or other, are repressed or suppressed. A lot of it is, I guess, so-called negativity, wishes of destruction, and, you know, anything that we would consider not acceptable. And that all gets pushed into the personal unconscious. if the personal unconscious is overflowing and has to come out, it often takes the form of problems that we would call, you know, symptoms of neurosis, in which you're either split off feelings, like there's too much feeling or there's too much thinking. There's an imbalance. And psychoanalysis, the basic idea is to make the personal unconscious conscious by putting it into language which is understandable. All right, works well. Jung came along, and because Jung was young, and I think this is also an important contribution I am making, is that Jung and Freud essentially are talking from different purposes. Freud really was talking about the essence of neurosis, in which that is essentially a three-party issue between a child, the mother, and the father, around three, and takes the form of what's called the Oedipus complex, or females, Electra, and so forth, of which he was steeped in it. Jung, on the other hand, had a pre-problem. He wasn't neurotic. He suffered from a lack of love and being nurtured, and had a sense of a split self, which later has become the essence of problems of self-pathology. So they were really talking over each other. They didn't really understand each other's experience. Freud, interestingly enough, was moving, he was a great researcher, he was moving towards an appreciation of experiences of the first 2 years, so-called pre-Oedipal. Unfortunately, I guess he died, but he was moving in that direction. So that I think probably if Jung had been open to it, the two might have really been able to collaborate.
Now, some people, when they hear the word consciousness, they think of one form of consciousness. Are there alternative forms of consciousness?
Thank you very much. I appreciate this. I have found that there are evolving levels of consciousness. And depending upon what level one is in, and I think everybody's in some level, the experience of synchronicities is going to have a particular flavor depending upon the level of consciousness which you bring to experience. So that if I can remember them, the first one is symbiotic consciousness, where if a baby could talk about what's real or what's their truth, they would say, my mother and I are one. It's the idea of bonding in which there are no boundaries. Kids are like, or maybe parents are like extensions of each other. Second level is what I call kaleidoscopic consciousness, which there are a number of people who can describe accurately what reality appears to be as if you were holding or looking through a kaleidoscope, and you see a kind of neat pattern of, let's say, colors, and it looks like maybe an artistic painting and so forth, shift the container a little bit, and that pattern completely dissolves, and in its place comes another pattern. And what becomes problematic is a lack of continuity between each shifting pattern. That is symptomatic of major issues of self-pathology. The next one is transcendent consciousness, which has to do with the idea of life is, and problems are very confusing, and I'm lost half the time, and I really wish there was somebody out there who would take care of me, and if it isn't a good parent or teacher, then I am going to project my need to be taken care of into the ether, and such fantasies, I think, of master teachers and guides and gurus and whatever, in effect, it's a wish to be rescued, in which the fantasy is that somebody knows me better than I do. Even if one feels ignorant about who one is, ultimately, you know what's best for you. Nobody can tell you what's best for you. The next one is transformative, in which there is an appreciation that one is split and that you have to really be educated to find out really what makes you tick so that you begin to go into inner space, identify splits, and work on yourself to make yourself whole. And then that leads to, what I say, transformational, transcendent, there's another one in there, a transitional, in which there is a growing sense of there probably is no external authority that knows me better than me, so I better try to figure out as best I can who and what I am and take responsibility for it, even though that's not easy to do. And then the next one is what I would call ego consciousness, not ego in the sense of conceit, but ego in the sense of being conscious. And with that, I came up with an idea that there are various streams of information, ideas, feelings, sensations, intuitions, and that if you can combine, synthesize, and be able to connect with the best of that, you can be able to tune into these various sources of information and then ultimately take all of them, which complement each other, and you can synthesize the messages or the knowledge that you are gaining from yourself. And that, in effect, I think, is what the creative process is.
And I think key among one of the things you said is learning who we really are. Because as I said before, we're always trying to learn from the outside, but really don't know who we are. And we have to take our one and only intermission. But when we come back, I really want to know what the factors are that initiate synchronicities or give them their, that we call it, crystallized form. And the biggest issue I had, Doctor, before, I didn't recognize at the time, it came later, was that I didn't recognize the characteristics. Are there specific characteristics by which we can recognize these synchronistic events as they are preparing to occur so that we can act upon them in a positive way? But we'll get your answer on the other side. How can people buy the book and learn more about your work, Dr. Williams?
Well, the first part is easy. Go to Amazon and look up Gibbs Williams, and the title is Demystifying Meaningful Coincidences, and in either paperback or Kindle or whatever. I can be reached at a couple of ways. My email is gwilliamsny11@aol.com. I have actually two websites. One is in action now, but the first one is gibsonline.com. And I think there's going to be one called drgwilliams.com, which is going to be activated in a few days or something.
No worries. We have links on our website. Folks, I'm here with Dr. Gibbs Williams discussing meaningful coincidences or synchronicities and much more when we return on part two. This is Mel Fabregas, and you are listening to Veritas. Don't go anywhere. Thank you for listening to the first segment of this very important Veritas interview. If you enjoyed it and wish to listen to the rest, go to veritasradio.com, click on members, or subscribe, or tell someone else who will enjoy this and all our radio programs. If you are listening on YouTube, like, subscribe, and share it. Don't forget to visit the Veritas store. Now, we'll take a short intermission, listen to some music, and I'll see you in the Veritas member section. Enjoy.